Hey, Nemo.
What, Darcy?
I found you.
Welcome to Finding Me.
Look at me, I'm funny. Look at me, I'm sad. Look at me, I'm sunny. Look at me, I'm bad. But it's an illusion, all I can be. Maybe I'm losing me. Don't wanna be let down, 'cause baby I am drowning. It's pulling me under. Lend me a hand today. Don't look at me, I'm tired. Don't look at me, I long for all that I desire, a place that I belong. But it's an illusion, all I can be.
You are listening to KPPP LP 88.1 FM Fargo-Moorhead, adding local color to your airwaves. And we are also broadcasting online through Shoutcast, and you can find us at kppfm.com. This is Finding Me with Darcy and Nemo. So Darcy, what do we have coming up on our show today?
Today we're talking about the intersections between Native identity and queer identity. We have with us in the studio tonight Hannah Youngdeer, an enrolled member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians, and a Master of Public Health student at NDSU focusing on American Indian health. We also will have on later Canadian pop stars Mary Black and Gabriel Guibauche of the Ojibwe First Nation. So I'm really excited about this show, Nemo. We originally had planned for other things but when I've been watching sort of the events...
At Sacred Stone.
Yeah, I've been watching the events at Sacred Stone unfold, and it's just really, it's kind of reopened some anger that I have about the treatment of Native people in the United States, especially here in North Dakota and to our neighbors to the south in South Dakota. And so we decided.
That yeah, we did.
I proposed, and then we decided together that it would be really good to have this show at this time, because we want to give voices to our Native brothers and sisters, especially the ones who identify as queer or as part of the sort of queer community. And so I wanted to make sure that they had a voice, because the mainstream media has really largely been misrepresenting their voices and really making a lot of a lot of nonsense out of what's going on.
Mm-hmm. Propaganda, lies,
all the justified upset, the justified frustration down near Standing Rock with the Dakota Access Pipeline. So I thought it was really important that we provide that space, but we also provide a space for queer voices because they get even more lost in the shuffle.
Mm-hmm. Indeed.
And, you know, it's sort of a mixed thing for me. Like, I've been enjoying watching the videos from Sacred Stone Camp because it makes me so happy to see so many different people coming together. And, you know, I think one thing that we as white people really don't understand is the magnitude of this, because these are tribes of Native people who have not really interacted on this level for a common goal against the oppression that they face. This is the first time that this has happened on this scale since Wounded Knee.
Right.
And it's really incredible to me to just watch, like, the different tribes roll in from all over the country. I mean, yet just, you know, the other day, the Aztecs down in Mexico arrived.
Mm. Yeah.
I mean, it's become a transnational. It's not just the United States. It's become a transnational North American Native people saying, look, we're done.
Mm-hmm. And some of the Lummi from Washington, which also I think extends into a little bit of Canada as well, came down with their totem pole.
Good. I just watching this thing grow has just been really exciting for me. But on the other hand, it's really upsetting to me. You know, I come from Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that we have to live with as Southerners, especially from Alabama, is the realities of the civil rights movement and the atrocities that were really done to the African American community in Alabama. I mean, scenes from Birmingham in the 60s, you have people peaceably protesting the treatment that they receive and then have dogs set on them or have fire hoses unleashed on them. Just the inhumane treatment of people. And so I see what's going on at Sacred Stone with the local law enforcement, with the security team hired to protect the Dakota Access individuals, the construction workers themselves. Just watching this violence, it reminds me very uncomfortably of what happened in Birmingham in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so watching this, it's sort of, you know, it provides me with this really weird range of emotions.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that I think is really important for us to talk about as white, I mean, I guess I'm the only white person here. It's important for me as a white person to communicate to other white people is that we are responsible for what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we may not have personally rounded up our Native American brothers and sisters and put them into reservations, but we allow it to happen. We allow the effects of it to happen every day, and we are complicit in that oppression. You know, I get so tired of hearing people say things like, we know Native Americans just take advantage of the system.
Oh my goodness. Quite the opposite.
the system that they live in is based on a treaty where the United States basically took their land.
Mm-hmm.
Not even basically. The United States took their land and then in exchange provided them with federal reservations for them to live on.
Mm-hmm.
Provided them with specific resources like the Indian Health Service, like, and also some of the other things that we typically like complain about Native Americans having. That is part of the treaty that we made with them.
Yeah.
And the thing that makes it so frustrating is that we gave them the worst land.
Yeah.
We gave them a really terrible health service.
Mm-hmm.
We basically, any Native programs are so underfunded, it's like, what's the point?
Mm-hmm. Stuff that you know, the government does not want.
Well, and what's really frustrating is if you really think about the way these treaties are designed and you think about the way that Native people live, these systems are designed to eradicate them, to get rid of them. You know, there's a person in North Dakota, her name is Ruth Buffalo, and I love Ruth. She is so inspiring to me. She got a Master of Public Health at NDSU's American Indian Public Health Program, and I've had the great honor of working with her and getting to know her. And one of the things that she says that just really has gotten to me is that as hard as it is to be a Native person, she is encouraged because her people are not supposed to be here. The system was supposed to have eradicated Natives by this point in history, and they're still here, which speaks to the resiliency of Native Americans, the fact that they have been pushed off of the land that was rightfully theirs, pushed into terrible reservations that are basically food deserts, that are economic disasters, not because of anything that they've done, but because they literally, like, are not given the same opportunity to have viable communities. They're pushed off of their land. They've been pushed into these terrible places, yet they're still here because they're not going to give up. And when I look at what's going on at Standing Rock, I'm like, this is a picture of why Native individuals are still here. And I was having a discussion earlier today with someone who's like, well, I don't understand why, like, it's this pipeline that has really mobilized this transnational Native, basically, sit-in. Why is it this and not, like, the other things, like the high suicide rate or the high rate of, like, alcohol-related disease, the high rate of other physical diseases, the high rate of malnutrition? And it's, you know, it reminds me of our discussion that we had weeks ago about Stonewall.
Yeah.
It's like Stonewall was a reaction to a police riot on a bar.
Uh-huh.
Now, the gay liberation movement wasn't based on this idea that we should be able to go to clubs and have drag and be able to drink in peace. That was not the point of the Stonewall riot. In our history, we come to this point where we can't take oppression anymore. We can't bear it anymore. And there's always this trigger. And I think, and this is what I hope, and this is what kind of keeps me in this place where I can watch what's going on down at Sacred Stone Camp and feel pride and feel like some form of hope, is that these people have experienced the last bit that they can take. And they are literally coming together and saying, we're done. We're not going to be silenced anymore. We're not going to be pushed around anymore. We have legitimate concerns and they will be heard. We have a treaty that will be honored. We have rights as human beings, but also as American citizens.
We have burial sites, sacred sites here.
Exactly.
Also, we're not only concerned for just our water. You guys are human too, and you also drink water. Don't think that your white privilege will protect you.
Yeah, because, I mean, and one of the things I've heard that's been said to try to diffuse the situation and kind of make the Native people look unreasonable is that, well, the pipeline doesn't even run through the reservation. No, but the river does. And the river flow, it's like literally the head, like close to the headwaters of the Missouri, and it runs all the way down to the, like, Mississippi River. Millions of people use that river as a source of water. And this is a legitimate concern that this pipeline will actually pollute water. But not to mention the fact that it potentially runs across a burial site. I mean, that alone, if it was like a Christian burial site, everyone would be up in arms. But this year has really, I think, separated the wolves from the lambs, because we've been able to see where people stand in terms of their view of minority ethnic groups, because you read media reports about this, you read politicians' reports about what's going on, and they haven't called the Native savages, but they might as well have.
Of course.
Because the language they use harkens back to that language of these unreasonable, naive, savage people who don't deserve to be treated. It's like, either assimilate or don't. Or don't exist.
Yeah, and I was talking to my mom this morning, thinking about how they really twist the story about yesterday's really disgusting show when they sick the dogs on mothers, children, and peaceful protesters. And then they twisted the story that the construction workers got hurt, and the people used flagpoles and ripped out the fences to cross into the work site. And so my interpretation of that, because I studied psychology and I study white people as just an observation, like, you know, how can this person react? How is this person going to react to my existence? And I thought to myself, you know what it is? They think we use some Indian magic. That's what it is. And that's why they're twisting it like this, because that's literally the only explanation they have, is their fear of us, our prayer, and our peacefulness, because it's working.
Well, and I think the other thing that we have to keep in mind is that whenever people stand up to bullies, because this is what they are, they're bullies. Whenever people stand up to bullies, it terrifies the bullies. Because that, it's effective. It's effective when people say, we're not doing this anymore. That scares people. It shakes the status quo. And we, as white people, have become accustomed to Native people knowing their place. And that place is on the res with their mouth shut. And I say that as in, that's what the status quo is, not what I actually believe.
Of course.
And now Native people are like, no, we're not going to be on the res. In fact, we're going to create a camp that isn't on the res. And we're not going to be quiet about it. And that scares people, because it shakes the status quo. And I love it. I'm just eating it up. Mm-hmm. I'm like, keep doing it. Like, same please. Here. And honestly, and I'm not saying this because I work with 88.1 FM, but all of the coverage on our station and all mm-hmm. the Native music has really been giving me life mm-hmm. over the last couple of weeks, because it's so refreshing to finally hear from a portion of our community that is just completely marginalized. I come from Alabama. I have seen firsthand the effects of American government policies on Native Americans. In my state, there is one Native American tribe that is recognized by the federal government. Just wow. one. Now, in my part of the country, there were many different tribes. The Cherokee Nation bordered one half of my state, the Creek Nation on the other. Two very large, prominent tribes that existed not that long ago. And now where are they? Oklahoma. Or completely eradicated. And that's because American policy on Native Americans is to push them away from anything that we want, and then to silence them by any means necessary if they try to push back from that. And that's ridiculous. It's absolutely ridiculous. So I'm really excited that we're having this massive transnational, trans-tribal protest down in southern North Dakota. I'm really excited that we have Native people with us on the show tonight who can talk. We'll use their own voice so that I don't have to
speak for them.
I don't have to speak for them, because I should not and I ought not. So I think it's time for me to stop talking now. We'll go to our break mm-hmm. and then we'll come back and we'll have wonderful Native voices. We'll give them the space to broadcast their message.
Mm-hmm. Let's dance.
I am standing, staring.
Welcome back. You're listening to KPPP LP 88.1 FM, Fargo-Moorhead. This is Finding Me with Darcy and Nemo. Today we're talking about the intersection between being Native and being queer. And we have with us in the studio right now, Hannah Youngdeer. She's from Cherokee, North Carolina. She is an enrolled member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians. She's getting a Master of Public Health from NDSU with a concentration in American Indian Health. And she's here to talk to us about her journey as both a queer person and as a Native American. Hannah, we're so glad to have you on the show with us tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So I was really excited when I met you a couple weeks ago because you have a little bit of a Southern accent, and it's nice to hear that again. But it's also cool because our paths have crossed before in some way. I've driven through Cherokee many times on my way to the Great Smoky Mountains. So I feel like our paths have crossed. Even if we didn't actually meet each other, our spirits maybe intersected at some point. So I'm really excited to have you here. Spreading some Southern cheer up in the Midwest. So, so we were talking earlier, though, about Native Americans in the area where I grew up, you know, the Creek Nation and the Cherokee Nation. And we were kind of talking during the break about how big the Cherokee Nation was. I mean, it covered a large portion of the Southeast. And then now what's left of it is pretty small.
Yeah.
And then the rest of it's over in Oklahoma. And then all of the nation that was in the land that my town was in, almost all of them are now in Oklahoma too. So I guess I'd like to start by talking about how that diaspora has affected your people, how you have been affected by the sort of physical and cultural break from one another and the separation that spans thousands of miles.
Well, there's a lot of factors that play into being separated like that. I guess if people don't know the history of our separation, I guess our big story in the Cherokee Nation is the Trail of Tears, in which treaties were made for our previous nation, which took up states from Tennessee, North Carolina, Georgia, South Carolina, Kentucky, and even Virginia. I mean, our nation was huge, but they brought in these treaties telling us that they would give us new land, new houses, new everything. So we were split, and there's a lot of history that goes back to why there are still Native Americans, Cherokee Native Americans, that are still in North Carolina today. But that's a whole other story. I guess a lot of it was just a loss of culture, and a lot of it was also a loss of language. Both the Western tribe in Oklahoma and the Eastern tribe in North Carolina, we are both fighting to keep our language going. I think we have 121 fluent speakers still in North Carolina. And that's scary, because to be a federally recognized tribe, you have to have a live language. So that would pull from funding and a lot of stuff that we get from the government, which is, you know, slim as it is. But a lot of it was just a culture loss, and even a power. Our voices were split. You know, there is power in numbers. So, you know, when they split up a lot of tribes, they do it through counties. They do it through state lines. That takes away their voices in those states. That's just how it works legally. When you're voting to have a voice in a county, back home he has a voice in Swain County, which is one of the counties that intersect our reservation. We are split between two counties, and that really takes away from our voices of being able to vote to put people on official boards that make decisions. And that is our voice, and that is one of the ways that we have lost that power to be able to make decisions within our own communities.
Well, I think that's something that a lot of people don't realize, is that these reservations aren't just in one geographic location. Mm-hmm. For example, Standing Rock, which is one of the largest reservations in our area, is split between North and South Dakota, which means this entire nation of people who identify culturally, through language, through customs, they're split in terms of their representative. It's not like their entire reservation is governed by their own law. They still have some intersections with state government. So I think that's something that we don't really think about, is that your voice is really segmented. Yeah. And honestly, like, the reality is that doesn't have to be that way. They could have put the reservation within one county. They could have reformed county lines. They didn't. And I think they did it for a reason.
Yeah.
And that is to keep you from having that power.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we see it all the time with gerrymandering, where you, like, especially in the South, like, I lived in one of the poorest neighborhoods in my city, and they redrew the voting lines so that this entire poor area did not fall into the same district, which meant Mai was being represented by someone who represented one of the richest neighborhoods in my town, which meant that my issues, like my, what was important to me, wasn't being represented at all because I was being outvoted by all these rich white people. So I think it's the same. It's really the same thing, right? You know, we're splitting. We're going to say, okay, we're going to give you a reservation, but then we're going to split it three ways. So you don't have any power. You're going to be voting along with these richer, better off white people who don't care about you, who in fact may be causing some of the problems for you. And that's just not okay. And one of the things that I thought was thinking about when you were talking about your language being fragmented, how many enrolled members are in your tribe?
That is a good question.
I'm looking it up right now because I want to know. So it looks like about 16,000.
Is so, that in the entire Cherokee Nation or
Eastern? This is from Wikipedia and it says Eastern Band. Okay. So, but that's 16,000 people and only 100, you said 100 native speakers?
Yes.
100 out of 16,000 people. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we really, as white people, comprehend how important language is, because it's our language that everyone's speaking. When you lose your language, you lose a lot of your tradition. I mean, I have a degree in English, and I can tell you, even in English, word meanings change. So looking at literature way, way back, sometimes you don't understand what they're talking about. But if it's in a completely different language, you lose a lot of that tradition, a lot of that custom, and you lose that the stories that make up your cultural identity. And like that just has to be psychologically devastating.
It's up there with cultural genocide, I believe, if to lose your language.
Yeah. And the thing is, Cherokee is such a beautiful language. It's not just beautiful to hear, but like the script is so pretty. It's like, I think, pretty unique, actually, because I don't think that really looks like anything else I've ever seen.
Yeah, I think it's one of the few written, I guess they like to call it an alphabet, but it's a syllabary. They like to call it one of the only ones for, you know, tribes around here. Because we had a guy that was willing to do that for us. And yeah, he was Native American too.
So you're studying public health, which is a really, I think I would say a tough field to go into, especially when you're a part of an oppressed minority group, because you learn about health outcomes, you learn about statistics related to health outcomes, and then you see it played out in your own life. Like, I know as a psychology student, it's hard for me a lot of times because I see these trajectories from minority groups and I'm like, oh, and it's hard because it's more personal. I think it's easier when you're kind of removed from that. What really brought you to public health as a profession?
Well, really, it's just what you were talking about coming up through my undergrad, through high school. We always saw these stats of, you know, Native Americans being one of the high rates in diabetes too, and high blood pressure and alcoholism, malnourishment, a lot of things like that. And you see that coming up, and when you see that statistic, it hit me hard because it's like, that's me. Those are my people. And I don't know, it sparked something in me. Like, if I just want to be able to make a difference, if I can just make those numbers go down somehow, some way, that's what drives me to get through this program, to do what I need to do to make a difference in Native American communities.
Yeah, for you, it's personal. It's not just a job.
Yeah.
It's like a mission to save, to help save your people from these really terrible outcomes that I think a lot of times we blame them for. Like, well, you know, if you just got off the res, then you'd be fine. Or if you just ate better, you'd be fine. And it's like, it kind of ignores the root problem.
Yeah.
That if you leave, then you lose that connection with your people. You lose the benefits that come with that. Your nation, and it's not just about you, it's about your nation. If you don't have sufficient numbers, then that could affect your standing federally. You know, and these reservations. Now, Cherokee, North Carolina isn't that isolated compared to, like, places here.
Yeah, it's, definitely
it's,
not.
It's, like, a good 40-minute drive from, like, another large town.
Yeah. But, yeah, we're very close to civilization.
And it's actually, it's a beautiful place. I just love driving through Cherokee, especially in the winter when it's kind of snowy. Like, there's just a little bit of snow. It's just, oh, beautiful. Love it. But then you have to think about, like, here in North Dakota, where basically no matter where you live, you're 40 minutes from a sizable settlement that may or may not have a grocery store. And then you look at where the reservations in North Dakota are located. They're hours and hours from grocery stores.
Creating a food desert.
Exactly. And then you know, the land may or may not be arable, and it may not be, like, economically viable to produce your own food. And so then you're isolated, you're having to go a long way to get food, you're having to spend a lot more money to get food, you already don't have a lot of money. It sets up an entire community of people to not do well. And I think that's something that we don't think about, and maybe you can speak more to this since you probably know more than I do about this, but... You know, we talk about the high rates of suicide, for example. I researched suicide among Native populations. Interestingly, the rate is almost on par with that of LGBTQ communities.
Mm-hmm.
It's actually really fascinating when you look at the two communities. They're kind of similar in size, similar in outcome.
Mm-hmm.
Just kind of goes to show what, like, being oppressed does to people.
Yeah.
But anyway, I don't know why I laughed at that. It wasn't really funny.
Well, it's like it's kind of like a black humor kind of funny, like, haha, but it's true.
But it's true. It's like... We like to make that, accredit that to, like, internalized characteristics. Well, you know, scare quote, Native Americans are just genetically not as superior as white people. And it's like, or perhaps they just come from a different place and they were exposed to different diseases. And so we have, like, immunities to a lot of these diseases because we have lived them from, like, the beginning of time. Whereas maybe over in North America, the Native people of North America didn't have the same, like, when you have people, like, going through experiences that genetically they haven't been habituated to over generation after generation after generation, it's inevitable that they're going to have a little bit of catching up to do. Can you speak to that? Does that sound like, am I completely off base here? I mean, public health is not my area.
No, we've actually talked about a lot of this in some of my classes already, about... You know, how a lot of Native Americans apt to get diseases, to get alcoholism. It is, we are not predisposed to that genetically, really. It's all about our resources. It is what we were given, you know, when we were removed to different lands. We were used to, before, you know, the Removal Act, you know, for before all of that, we were used to living in a specific place. We knew what we could grow. We knew the kind of food we could get. We knew that environment. That has a lot to do with it. But when they removed us, you know, we only knew what the government brought us. The commodity foods that we were all served, you know, like cheese and bread, like a lot of carbs.
And cheap stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Because it's government. Definitely. Remember that. The government's providing the food.
Yes, exactly. You know, we didn't know how to grow our own food when we were moved to different places.
And mm-hmm. and not because you were stupid, no. But because it was different climate, different land.
Yes.
I mean, I have been to Oklahoma. I have been to Cherokee, North Carolina. Complete night and day.
Mm-hmm.
Literally different climates.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it was different for our people to have to learn and adjust to do that. Because, you know, we had, like, our own tools and stuff that we had to use. And a lot of people, you know, they had to leave those. And when we were put on these new lands, there was nothing there. And the government wasn't, after those removals, going to provide us with those tools that we needed.
It's like, here's your land, bye.
Yeah, yeah, basically. So I feel like our history has a lot to do with the health problems that we have now.
Mm-hmm.
They talk a lot about, in the health field, adverse childhood effects.
Mm.
And there's no proven research, I guess, to suggest that it has genetically changed us. But that does happen. And there are theories that say that. There are theories around that say, you know, that we were genetically modified to predispose to different diseases. But really, it was just the underfunding, the underproviding from the government.
Yeah. And the Trail of Tears was, you know, I'm looking at the Googles because I need to know all the things. But the Trail of Tears started in 1838, so, and it ended in 1839. And that's like almost 170-something years ago.
Yeah.
That's not a long time in the greater scheme of things. I mean, our country is like around 300 years old. So, I mean, half of our history ago. Like, that's not a long time. I think we like to think that that's a long time. But, I mean, that's, you can count the number of generations on both hands.
Mm-hmm.
That's not that long ago. You don't recover from something like that. I mean, our culture, our larger culture is still largely adjusting to the fact that, you know, adjusting from being a new nation, from really separating culturally from continental Europe in terms of, like, white people culture. Mm-hmm. I gotta check myself, check my privilege here. But we're still adjusting to that, I think, in a lot of ways, still coming into our own. You know, we're still a very young nation. We have a lot of problems, and we have had several hundred years to figure that out. But in 170-something years, it's hard to recover, especially when you're removed, and then you're moved again, and then you're moved again.
and you're kind of sabotaged throughout the whole way.
It's not been easy. It's not like you moved and then you had, like, you started rebuilding. It's like reservation change all the time. I mean, think about the three affiliated tribes up near near Minot. That reservation has changed drastically in 50 years. I mean, they dammed the river, displaced thousands of Native people, completely messed up the economic stability that they had found since being removed there. And now that nation is struggling because of that. That's just one generation, or two generations have been trying to rebuild from that, and they still are working on it. It's like the effect, I think what you're saying and what I'm hearing from you is that it's hard to overcome effects of like a huge transition like that. And we're not talking like, oh, we just moved 50 miles upriver. We're talking like we moved thousands of miles from the climate that we're used to, from the culture that we're used to. You know, I just moved here from Alabama a year ago. I still haven't completely adjusted. Like, my body's telling me right now it's supposed to be about 80 to 90 degrees. This is like in Alabama one of the hottest parts of the year. It's starting to get cold. My body has not started to accustom to like the fact that it's about to be freezing. And that's a whole different struggle right there, is how cold it gets in the winter. So imagine leaving North Dakota, if you've lived here your whole life, and then moving to Florida, where it's hot every day of the year.
Mm-hmm.
The coldest it gets in Florida is like 50 degrees. And that's like, it snowed in northern Florida like last year, and it was like the first time in 50 years I had snowed. So imagine going from snow all the time to no snow ever. It's always hot. You're always like sweating. It's like walking through soup because the humidity is like 99%. It's a huge transition. And for a large group of people like this, moving from one side of the country to the other and then being like completely uprooted, and that you can't recover from that. And I think ultimately that's sort of what's happening with the Standing Rock Coda people, but more broadly at Sacred Stone Camp, is I think these nations are finally saying, look, man, this has not been fun. It has not been easy, and we can't take it anymore.
Mm-mm.
And it's time for you to acknowledge what you've done to us. Is it a legitimate concern? Absolutely. Is it a legitimate protest? Definitely.
Mm-hmm.
And we here on Finding Me support that, because we're all about people finding themselves, finding their identity in the midst of chaos, in the midst of erasure, in the midst of destruction of everything that we hold dear. So we're with you. And is it going to be easy? No, it isn't. But the thing that keeps me going is the knowledge that when we do this together, when we find each other together, it's so much more enjoyable. So that's why I'm so heartened to see all of these people finding themselves, finding their future, and building their future together down at Sacred Stone.
Mm-hmm.
When we come back, we'll keep talking with him, and we'll have our guests from Canada on with us, and we're just going to keep having some kind of hard but kind of great discussions here on Finding Me. You're listening to KPPPLP 88.1 FM, Fargo, Moorhead.
The rhythm of the breath through her chest is a melody that entices every inch of me. She has me obsessed because her figure is picturesque. She is as perfect as a portrait and could not possibly be less. She is the true embodiment of divinity. And with just a simple grace, her touch, it brings me to my knees. She is intelligent, but a different kind of intelligence. See, she speaks in languages that I have yet to fully learn, to Creator and the heavens and Mother Nature. She articulates her innovative ideas through art and shapes through music the hardships and joy in her heart. To say she mesmerizes me would be an understatement. My heart is racing while my mind is pacing. Her brilliance is astonishing and at times frustrating as I'm concentrating, sometimes struggling to comprehend what her beautiful mind is contemplating. Beautiful. She is beautiful, but a different kind of beautiful. See, she carries beauty so alive that it couldn't be retraced. Alone, her face could put Van Gogh, Picasso, and Michelangelo to shame. Nah, the world's greatest artist could never paint the perfection that exists within the mere shadow of her frame. Her touch is so gentle that it strokes the most rigid of objects as if she were feeling the skin of a baby. She graced me with her softness, and it was through her love she saved me. She is delicate, but a different kind of delicate. Her skin is so tender that when I caress her, it feels as soft as the powdery butterfly's wings. Have you ever held somebody so closely yet so gently to your heart, wishing your arms could act as iron bars defending her, trying desperately to use your body as medicine for her scars, pulsating, aching in every single bone to protect her from the cruelty beyond the walls of your sanctuary, your home? And when you cannot respond to the disrespect towards her, the world's painful words, but only hope that the love that you express in a verse can heal her bleeding wounds and take away the hurt. Have you ever laid beside her, shaking inside, with tears in your eyes while she cried, wishing upon every star in the night sky that you could take her pain, begging Creator to let you take it all away, knowing that you could fall off a cliff and rip every single muscle on your way down, and it would hurt you less than seeing her beautiful face frown? Because I have. She is strong, but a different kind of strong. This woman was more than a diamond in the rough. Surrounded by abuse, neglect, and drugs, she emerged, and from that darkness, from her strife, created her own path, and she brought the light to life. She is a warrior of the Horse Clan, gifted with the hidden physical capability of any man, with a voice that is fearless. She is not afraid to stand for the people, for our culture, our rights, and our land. And I'll stand firmly beside her as we fight hand in hand the oppressors and the perpetrators until society understands a love like ours. See, I am a woman, and I am in love with the woman. But not just anyone. No, she's a different kind of woman. She walks between worlds like the angel Gabrielle. She carries two spirits, so it's impossible to tell. She is stunning, absolutely divine in every aspect of her being without even trying. She is my love and thus my light. And when she became my wife, she brought with her a purpose to my life. She is my destiny, and she will always, always, always be a part of me. For I see her in the dancing leaves on the trees. I can smell her in the dew of the sweet morning breeze. Her eyes, they glisten like the morning sunrise. It is a miracle for which every day I am thankful. She loves me. For regardless of how long or how hard I try, I could never compete or come close to being worthy of sleeping on my perfect queen.
Welcome back to Finding Me here on KPPP LP 88.1 FM Fargo Moorhead. We've been talking about Native American issues tonight with our special guest, Hannah Youngdeer, member of the Eastern Band of Cherokee Indians and Master of Public Health student at NDSU. In our second hour, we would like to turn our attention to queer Native voices.
Hannah, we've heard a lot about the oppression faced by Native Americans, and I think we've really had the opportunity to speak pretty thoroughly on that topic. I've just really enjoyed having you on in the first half hour. And the theme of this show is queer identity. Mm-hmm. And you identify as a lesbian. Mm-hmm. That's another aspect, another facet of your beautiful life tapestry. And we've talked here on the show, we have talked a lot about the experiences of LGBTQ plus folks. And we're just going to put it out there. They're also oppressive. And so, you know, as a person who identifies as Native and a person who identifies as a lesbian, you get sort of a double whammy on oppression. So what I'm wondering is what it looks like when you take the oppression that you face as a Native person and you intersect it with the oppression that you face as a queer person. And so I'd like to give you an opportunity to really talk about the intersectionality that exists in your life.
I think from a standpoint, you know, I'm not able to speak on the acceptance of the LGBT plus community within the region that we're in. Now, but I know back home the intersection between tribal and queer issues it's very closed off. It's not open, really, and I think a lot of that has to do with the religion, you know, that we have been exposed to for many years. And that also ties into the history of the Native peoples. Whenever settlers came in, they exposed us to religion, and that still influences our people today. So where I'm from, it's very, very religious.
And we're talking the Christian religion?
Yes, okay. Christian. Back home exclusively, yes. So I think it's hard because you come from two different communities. You come from your Native community, and you come from your queer community. But it's hard when they clash. For me, they clash. Because within my tribe, it's not accepted. For example, whenever gay marriage was made legal in the state of North Carolina, we are sovereign from the state. Our reservation is sovereign from the state. So on my reservation, tribal council went over it. Are we going to let gay marriage be legal on the reservation? And they decided not to do that. So I think that's where it really intersects is we don't have to follow those rules that the government makes or that... Well, rather, like, nationally that they made gay marriage legal. Because I come from there, I can't get married where I've grown up my entire life.
I mean, you could, like, somewhere else. Like,
yeah.
Say if you went off the reservation in North Carolina, or if you went to, like, here, for example. But what you're saying is, among your own people, in the community that is your home, you can't, because it's against the law in your tribe.
Yes, that's exactly how it is. And, of course, you know, a lot of it is the religious influence that comes in.
Mm-hmm.
And what I was hinting at earlier about those two clashing, it's hard when you can't get acceptance from your Native American community about being queer, because that is one of your support groups. That is who you try to draw support groups from. Those are your people. Those are the people that you feel comfortable with. And whenever they don't support you, it's hard, because that's the support group that you depend on, that you've depended on your whole entire life to have your back. Whenever I decided to come out to college in North Dakota, my mom sat me down and talked to me about leaving the reservation and going out to the world. She said, here, you are a Native American. You are with your own people. And they recognize that. They'll give you opportunities to do something with your life. They'll take up for you whenever something happens to you. But when you go out into the world from your Native community, you don't have that support. You are not one of the big minorities out there. You're not African American. You're not Hispanic, Latino. You're not any of those. You're not a part of those big populations. You don't have that representation. She said, out there, you are just somebody else, she said, and they don't recognize you as, you know, a regular person, because you don't look like them. So it is hard not having the support from the community that you feel so comfortable in, that you've always depended on for support.
And, you know, I definitely understand that, because, you know, I'm Christian, and I actively participate in my religion. And I'm very, very fortunate that the church that I go to, St. Stephen's Episcopal here in Fargo, is both open and affirming of queer identities. But when I came out, I was a member of the Church of Christ, not to be, you know, confused. You know what I'm talking about.
I
not to be confused with the United Church of Christ. The Church of Christ is predominantly a Southern version of the Christian religion.
Mm.
And when I came out as a gay man in 2010, I was rejected by this. And my church was central to my identity, still is a very large, I mean, my religion is central to my identity still, but the spiritual life that I had with my worshiping community in back in Alabama was central to my identity, and then I lost that because I wasn't welcome within that. So it's almost like when you accept one side of your identity, it's almost rejecting the other. And what's so upsetting about it is, you know, when you think about the history of Native peoples, queer individuals often called two-spirit. It's a modern term to describe multiple identities. But this was something that could be found in every Native American tribe. And it's gone now, largely, as a mainstream ideal because of the boarding school era of American history, where we put Native American children in these boarding schools, cut their hair, force them to speak English, force them into the Christian religion. Suddenly they lose everything that makes them unique, that makes their identity what it is. And as a result, now we have people really going against what was once a strong cultural value. And, you know, it's upsetting. And it's upsetting that a person should have to give up their identity, or give up one of their identities. Because for me, and I can't speak to your experience because I didn't have it, but I can speak to mine. And from my experience, it was either I had to give up Christianity or I had to give up being queer. And I was very fortunate that I was able to find a worshiping community where I could be both. And it seems like, from what you're saying, that you kind of are in the same place, where it's like you either give up your Cherokee identity or you give up your queer identity. But what my hope is that you'll be able to find a way to embrace both.
I think I can speak a lot to what you were saying about choosing your identities, because I grew up Christian.
Mm-hmm.
When I was younger, my dad was a preacher. It's still a challenge for me to try and find that religious piece of me that can still be that person, because for a while, after I came out, I got my first girlfriend. That was really hard to deal with first, because, I mean, I knew I was happy, but you battle with the things that you grow up learning, with the things that you've been told about homosexuality being wrong. And people, when you talk about being queer religion and how most religions will, the Christian religion will call it a sin, people will argue with you up and down. It's not a sin. It's not a sin. But it's different when you grew up believing that yourself, because it's hard to accept the fact that it's different for you.
Yeah. And it can really, like, it's really toxic.
Mm-hmm.
I can agree with this. I was raised Catholic, as a child up until I ended up moving here in Moorhead. My parents were divorced for a period of time. Then my mom didn't go to church for a while. And then my mom and I were stuck in an abusive household for a bit before we moved to Moorhead. Our abuser said that he was a Christian and he would take us to church and everything, but he was very racist, very homophobic. I thought about my past and why I was afraid to come out, and it was because of him. Because to protect myself, I had self-loathing because I was finding something in myself that I didn't like because it was going to make it harder for me to survive. I regret to this day telling a friend of mine that I had at the time that I thought being gay was a sin. And I call out to that person to apologize because I didn't know better and I was also scared for myself. But now my mom and I have read through the Bible. We've analyzed it better in the safety of a positive environment. And we realize that God loves everybody, for real. None of this, like, you know, these people are going to hell. It was nice to learn in a more mature, positive environment that the reason Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed was because not only was there crimes there, but there was also rapists there. And that's what was happening to the angels that the men wanted at Lot's house.
You know, I think that I like what you said about, you know, thinking about your identity in a safe environment. I think that's really important. And I think what your story, Nemo, is telling us is that we can find our identity. We can reconcile our intersections when we're in a safe environment, mm-hmm. which gives me hope because it means that we can still be who we are. We don't have to give up any aspect of our identity, be it as a Christian, be it as a Native person, and as a queer person. We don't have to give that up. We can reconcile. There's always a way to reconcile it. Sometimes it just requires that we put ourselves in a positive environment. And it's almost like that's what Sacred Stone is. The Sacred Stone Camp, is it a completely positive environment? No, because outside people are trying to destroy it. But what it is it's groups of people coming together and saying, look, we're all different. I'm Lakota. I'm Hidatsa. I'm Aztec. I'm Cherokee. I'm Chippewa. We're all different cultural identities, different backgrounds, different histories. Maybe those histories included us fighting each other. But one thing we can agree on is that our identity is sacred. And we can, together through our prayers, through our songs, through our togetherness, we can find that peace in the midst of turmoil. That even when dogs are being unleashed on us, even when backhoes are getting into position to rip up the land, that we can find a little bit of peace in knowing that we are journeying together to find our identity. Hannah, I want to thank you for coming on the show today. I really appreciate having you speak to your experiences both as a Native American and as a queer woman. And we look forward to all the great things you're going to do as a public health specialist and hopefully having you back on the show in the future to talk more about the work that you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely.
And now a look at queer news and upcoming queer events.
Find out more about Sacred Stone Camp and the DAPL Resistance Movement at sacredstonecamp.org. There you can donate to the Legal Defense Fund, find out how to donate supplies, and join the movement.
Friday, September 16th at 8 p.m. is the beginning of the FM LGBT Film Festival at the historic Fargo Theater. Tickets will be sold at the door for $7 or for $25 for a festival pass to view all four screenings on Friday and Saturday. For more information, go to fmlgbtff.com.
On our next show, we will talk to Mary Black and Gable Gibosh of the Ojibwe First Nation in Canada. Tune in next week at 5 p.m. on Wednesday here on KPPPLP 88.1 FM.
Tonight's show was written by Darcy Corbett and produced and engineered by Nemo Cicados. Finding Me is a project of KPPPLP 88.1 FM Fargo-Moorhead.
KPPPLP is adding local color to your airwaves. We're broadcasting on Shoutcast, and you can find us on your radio dial at 88.1 FM here in the Fargo-Moorhead region. You can contact us at 701-566-0917, at @media_PPP, email Cindy at kpppfm.com, or Duke at kpppfm.com. Follow us on Facebook at 88.1 FM Fargo-Moorhead, the People's Press Project, and Mexican.
Donations to Fargo-Moorhead's newest low-power, commercial-free radio station can be made at our website on kpppfm.com.
Thanks for tuning in. See you next Wednesday at 5 here on Finding Me.
Two-spirit in the house right now. 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 Watch it.
said you're so mad, it's got nothing to do with you. Wish you would deal with these issues at hand. Pick city by man, you can break what I have. Self-made is not fair. Through them pigments and this big city res dog. This big city res dog. This big city res dog. Crystal that I have. Think I just sit on. No, you don't know me like that. I see you hate on. But you don't understand. If I'm a CEO, what's a knock at? Bitch, she bunga, she moogie, sis, got we know we had any time, we sung and done it. No more. If I'm a CEO, what's a knock at? Bitch, she bunga, she moogie, sis, got we know we had any time, we sung and done it. No more. Do it on my own, I'ma get mine on. I'm gonna slow down when it all goes to the moon. Native like who? Native, I'm a true. Native, what it do? I glow like the sun when it rise up. Native, I'm gonna shine like I'm fired up. Singing my eyes, sacrifice my life for the ones that don't get no love shown from these haters right on now. They gon' hate, but only now. We gon' make it on my mind. Gonna native on the grind like all the time. I'ma get mine, no. They gon' hate, but only now. We gon' make it on my mind. Gonna native on the grind like all the time. I'ma get mine, no. They better see I was a knockin'. Bitches, she bunga, she moogie, sis. Got we know we had any time. We sung and down there. No more. They better see I was a knockin'. Bitches, she bunga, she moogie, sis. Got we know we had any time. We sung and down there.